Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. I'm a virtual audience. Thank you very much for joining us. So over the course of the last 33 and a half years, one of the most wonderful things that we've been able to do with the Poison Fam was introduce you to new authors. It's just been a real joy and a discovery. And today we are very pleased to be introducing you to this lovely lady over here on my left, who is a poet and a professor and a debut novelist. And you've actually published works of poetry, right? So, fiction. And with her, amazingly, is her publisher. I know, I could have had so much fun to introduce Gillian Lynn to you as a publisher. So, Gillian, as you know, is the author of three books, Sharp Objects.
Dark Places.
Dark Places, and of course, Fine Girl, and who knows what might be coming along. But Gillian has done something I think is truly wonderful, which is that she has developed an imprint at a small publisher called Sando, which means that authors who might not be able otherwise to be published for various reasons have a better chance. So I'm really delighted with that. And that's all I'm going to say. So I'm going to turn this over to Margo and Billy and move on along.
Thanks.
You bet.
Y'all hear me?
Yeah. I don't know if that affects. Yeah, better.
Maybe.
That's going to be seen louder. I don't know if it affects the filming, but.
Can I turn it over? Can everyone hear? Is this okay?
Yes,
it's
fine.
Okay. Sorry. So, hello.
Hi.
Thanks, everyone, for having us and for coming out. Sorry about my weird introduction. I'm starting over. I am proud to present Margo and her first book. The second I read it, and it was the very first book of my new imprint at Sando, and I was trying to find just the right one to start with, because you know you have to, you start getting a little, you know, setting the table for what I'm excited about, what I want to publish. And the second I read Margo's book, I said, this is the one. And I love her voice. She's got this big voice, but it's not overly powering. It's not a show-off voice. It's just proud and big and lyrical at the same time, which is so hard to pull off, to do both those things. I have a character who's both opinionated and dark, troubled. I'll never say the word likable because I don't care about that, but interesting. and the curious, and it makes you, because of that, makes you care about her because you're with her on her journey. And to me, this is all about, you know, finding grace within yourself. Margo, I have many skill sets, but one of them is not like the dialogue of what a book is exactly about. So I would love you to just speak to the basics of the book. I'll let you do that. And then I want to hear kind of that little piece that really started the whole idea.
And it's just, I will never get used to the fact that my publisher is Gillian Flynn, everybody. I mean, it is truly... It's, you know, we've become friends, you're like a mentor to me, and I just respect him so much. But first and foremost, I'm the biggest fan ever. So when, you know, I heard that the Gillian Flynn wanted to publish my, you know, wild and crazy, hard-boiled, inspired mystery, it's just a feeling like I can't explain. It's something that I've wanted to do, that's lived in my heart, lived in my mind for about 10 years. As a hardcore mystery fan, as a poet, as someone who believes in the transformative power of storytelling, and as a queer author, you know, there's so much in this book that speaks to what I find redemptive and life-giving about stories generally, and the ways that our, you know, the creations that we make, whether they're books or films and screenwriting, can actually change culture and change our lives because these characters live within us. So thank you. And also thank you to everyone for coming out today, and Barbara Peters, the icon herself, just being here is also a tremendous, incredible honor for me. Again, as someone who just has fangirled over all the authors that have come here, you've probably all seen them. We have a great community here, so it's just a great honor for me to be here. And Scorched Grace. I think the title gives us a little bit of, you know, what this, if this were the title of a poem, you would get, you know, would point to the heart of what this book is about. And I've always been obsessed with the notion of that lone wolf sleuth, like we've talked about, you know, noir movie marathons on TCM and, you know, a lone wolf on the mean streets, pounding the pavement, pat the trench coat in the load. There, that world has always intrigued me, a world of contrasts. The noir being a space that is actually quite intimate in its exploration of despair and decay, the things that actually make us human, the humanness of our need to go on despite the brutal and kind of vicious and beautiful world that we live in. So ultimately, yes, it's a bit of a...
You did that much better than I did.
That's the big, you know, big brush strokes of it. You know, the
yes, that's why I taught it.
Thank you for doing it. Would you like to hear some of it?
I would love it. Where should we start? I want to give everyone, if they have not had a chance to read it yet, an idea of what this book feels like and why it will just pull you in immediately. Just a dash about what it's like boils down to, which the primary narrator, the narrator here is a queer ex-punk rock ex-addict nun, like a nun, right? Who
stay with us?
Yeah,
check.
In New Orleans, and you know, tattooed, sleeved, has to wear gloves to cover them up. Because she's in a convent that, you know, is tighter. And, you know, chain smoking behind the corners. And there's an arson that happens that's very close to the heart of the church that pulls her in and makes her want to solve what's happening. It gets worse. It gets more and more intense. And she gets more and more intense. And the whole time, in the meantime, she's really battling these inner demons. And to me, I read it and I'd be like, I like you because I like me. But it reminded me of my first book, Sharp Objects, which is very much about a woman going to a very specific town and dealing with solving what's happening there, murders, while she's battling addiction and mental illness. So they had pitched me Margaret's book and they had said, it's about a queer ex-punk rock ex-addict nun. And I was like, this sounds like the weirdest murder she wrote. Yeah, I love murder she wrote. But then I like, it's so hard-boiled. Read it. And I was in from page one. I was so, like, psyched about it. It just pulls you in, the sense of place, the sense of the personality, this exciting mystery. I mean, it just, for me, had it all, so. I'm just setting up, and I'll now let you read.
I'm sure you've all read Maltese Falcon, you know, big mystery fans here. So he's, again, that idea of the lone wolf sleuth, he's got the cigarette, and he's, like, punching out, you know, Thurston, never loses the cigarette from his mouth. And that swagger, that brio, always captivated me from those early novels of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and I wanted to inhabit that space and flip it completely with queerness and also spirituality. And, you know, rethinking how
what a female, did we grow up with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And still in that space, you know, of what hard-boiled, hard-drinking, hard-living means and the ways that they're kind of code-bound rather than rules, and they'll bend rules if necessary, taste for vice. So all of that, you know, inspired my creation of this character who is in her art genuinely about. And so a lot of people just don't know what to make of her. That, for me, was a start of a character that I wanted to follow. You know, that's when we think of the sleuths and the detective characters that occupy our hearts and our minds, like Poirot or Miss Marple or Spade or Chandler, whoever they are. Oh, sorry. Whoever they might be.
Understand.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
Blue Archer.
Blue Archer.
My favorite.
Yeah, I love Blue Archer.
I love Blue Archer.
He's sort of more on my B-side, but I love it.
Yeah. Solid B-side.
So we have this. Thank you very much. Yeah. And thanks for watching. the rectangles. So I'll share it from the first couple of pages through the voice of Sister Bombay, this 33-year-old woman who makes this iconoclastic move to join the convent, moving from Brooklyn to New Orleans. For reasons that you start to piece together as clues of the arson start to piece together too. We were a progressive order, but Catholic sisters all the same, with rules to follow, or in my case, to test. We were focused, working diligently at the school, the church, the prison, and our convent. Our bedrooms were modest. Our convent bathroom was Spartan and cavernous with a musty, sepulchral air. No mirrors anywhere. No blow dryers. Shower stalls sported cheap plastic curtains. When I spaced out in the shower, never for too long, Sister T timed me to preserve water. I'd watch droplets form like little stalactites on the ceiling. The convent's common areas were as austerely appointed as holy tombs, and as cold, the blessing and the sweltering, insistent heat. Even my shady alley was blazing hot. I had my goddamn gloves and scarf on that Sunday, as Sister Augustine demanded, and it felt like they had melted into my skin. It was still a glorious moment alone, before the staff meeting adjourned, before I stepped into the convent for supper, with two cigarettes collected on Friday afternoon, nabbed from behind Ryan Brown's pointy ears. Oh, sister again? Ryan Brown, sophomore at St. Sebastian's School, the king of cell phones, whined after I took his smokes. Come on. He threw his hands in the air like a toddler. Of all my students, he had absolutely no street smarts. My contraband supply flowed through this curious kid. Most students fled the instant I walked into a room, whereas Ryan Brown lingered. His flagrant violations of our tobacco rules made it seem like he was trying to get caught. He was bad at being bad. Not like me. I held up the cigarettes. Showing off your smokes makes you a tough guy, huh? But I learned how to fight for what you want. I cut Ryan off. No time for excuses. Or learn how to hide it better. Otherwise, you'll lose everything. My wisdom held kind of grace, I'll admit. I offered my students the only thing that mattered in life, honesty. And I served it the way I meted out revenge, ice cold. I was an F-up. I'm not sure if I can curse on Zoom. I was an F-up about most things. But when it came to commitment, I was all in. Like a python eating a goat, sinew and toenails and skeleton and all. Like my sisters, I did everything I could to lift each student, to help them carry the light in their own hands, not hold it for them. And sometimes that meant calling out their sloth and turpitude. And I knew how to clock BS because I lived it. To break a horse or a human, you must first understand wildness. So we get this character, she's stealing this, you know, the cigarettes from the kids that aren't, they're not allowed to have it. So whatever, you know, vice she can take from them, then she goes and enjoys in her alley. And she's chain smoking these very fine cigarettes because the students are a little bit on the wealthy side. And that's when she, as she's, you know, smoking, she sees what might be or might not be the inciting incident, which is the flames shooting through the second floor window of her school, and then a flaming body, a flaming angel of her friend falling through, which launches the mystery into its full throttle and really doesn't quite look back from that. But I wanted to, you know, really ground the first moments of the book, very much like in Sharp Objects, when we're learning about Camille Preaker's penchant for thrift clothes with the tag still on them, and her boss with that drinks the schnapps, yeah. And just the fingertip feel of a life through the contours of their complex mind, and you know some of those details that I'll never forget from reading your books. You know, the someone who I could quote your books all day, but yeah, those little details.
Speaking of which. Like, I remember from first reading it, tasting to hold the light themselves. That line, rather than hold it for them, was really, I knew who this person was. I knew that whatever you say, you know, about her background or about her toughness or about, know, her anger and issues, that she had an innate grace and kindness to her. I mean, that to me, that was really meaningful. I knew from exactly that moment, like, oh, I'm with this person. And what I love about this character is, I think it's very easy to pick a nun and sort of have a stereotype. It's okay. Not a stereotype, but at the same time, maintains why a woman or a person has a spiritual journey and how, and it treats that very carefully and gently and kindly, I think, in a way that we don't always find in real life. There's a real empathy and understanding, and like, you, whatever religion you are, if you're not a religion, you can certainly understand that love of grace. I mean, keep saying grace because that's
so much
the love of grace. But yeah, I mean, I really think that's really meaningful and really unusual that you can have, and of course you can have both these sides. You can have the darkness and the light. Most people do. But it's not balanced quite enough in the literature. You have to have a character as either like full on evil or full on good doer. Says the woman who wrote Gone Girl.
Yeah. Gave us Amy Dunn.
Sometimes you don't have to have it.
I so agree, and those are the characters that I again want to follow into the Ozarks, or you know, into the mayhem and into the revelry and into the joy. Is that someone who's a character who can surprise themselves will surprise the reader, and
so true. Let me ask you this. Speaking of that, did you surprise yourself? You tell me this. Did you surprise? Can you tell me? Hang out too much. Did you surprise yourself along the way? Because I don't outline my books. In theory, I had tried to with my first book, and I went so off the rail that I thought I never have since. Just like let the characters and let that moment lead you and see. I mean, to me, you can outline and you can stick to the outline, but that would ruin the very magic of writing, which is when a character or a moment surprises you and you get completely derailed from what you thought the book was. It's not a very efficient way to write a book. It's the only way I know how to. So I'm curious about like if there were any moments where you thought like, oh, this Sister Holiday.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, I lay a baseline. So for me, knowing the plot points that are real fulcrums, I have to know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A little bit like going on a road trip, you know, you know your destination and might not know exactly how to get there. And you may even, I try to bake in space for getting lost, for improvisation, because for me, it is that channeling of the voltage.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Eros and Thanatos, it's the life urge, it's the death urge. And if you have too firm of a grip, you squeeze the life out.
You're going way over my head. That's fine.
Like,
yeah, this is the PhD talking here. But
that was a terrible student. I was an absolutely horrible, any students watching, any of my students, you know, I get you, I love you. I was not, you know, and I write about a teacher, high school teacher, you know, she's a guitar teacher in Brooklyn. She's in her Fry Girl post-punk band called Original Sin. And then she moves to New Orleans and joins the Sisters of the Sublime Blood. But she's, you know, has these relationships with her high school students, like Prince Dempsey and Ryan Brown, because she knows them. She's just like with Raymond Chandler, Trouble Is Our Business. She knows the trouble. She knows what their mischief and the hijinks that they get up to. And it yokes them together in a lot of ways. But the laying of the sort of the baseline for the outline, though, it does give me ground underneath my feet so that I can play. And really treat it like poetry in the sense that there's always subtext and always something withheld. And then there's misdirection, there's red herring, and even the way that this character, Sister Holiday, sees the world is constantly connecting unlike things through either just metaphor or the way that she's trying to piece together the clues of this arson and these murders is giving the reader that kind of through line into the world as well as how she's trying to solve this mystery. So I had to, you know, it was a long process of writing the first draft. It took me more than more than, you know, 2 years to do that first draft. And then the first chapter, once I found that rhythm, and I think crime fiction has a rhythm. It has tempo. Once I got, when I locked into that, then I could really tighten it, define it, and find that, you know, that, like, Lorca's idea of duende, which is blood under the sand, fire and passion, when you see people, like, doing tango or something. So Sister Holiday sort of has that duende almost at every moment, and I wanted that to also be part of her stooping, for good and for bad. You know, it gets in her way, her biases, where she... You know, her occlusions and things that she's totally convinced that she doesn't trust the cops, you know, she doesn't trust people. She doesn't sometimes trust herself, and yet she's also, like, really hot-headed and really, you know, hot-tempered in the kind of a Sam Spade way. So all of that is part of that, you know, experience of being her. She's really writing this letter to you. I thought that's what I loved so much about Gone Girl, is you have these two narrators that both kind of grab you by the collar and put you in a headlock, Nick Dunn, and, you know, and then for me, that when I read work like that, that feels like it's just written for me. It's just so stuck to me.
How do you feel? We're talking about voice, and did you know Sister Holiday's voice from the, did she come out of you kind of immediately? Because I know for me, I struggle to find Camille's voice in Sharp Objects and Dark Places, which was my second book. I said, well, you know, I don't want to be known as the woman who writes dark female narrators. Have you seen how well that turned out? Yeah,
it's worked out pretty good.
And so I wrote this, so this woman, I knew the plot. It was, it's kind of my fascination with true crime, but what happens when the burst of true crime is the spotlight is off, and how you live with that than being suddenly alone. And so I knew this girl was a famous survivor of a famous massacre. Her family was axe murdered. And then I wrote the entire first draft with her as, like, this peppy, like, cheerleader-like gal who had solved all her demons and was best friends with her child's psychiatrist, and they hung out, and, I mean, I should send this out to the world for everyone who's struggling with the first draft to be like, dude, so we've all been there, I promise you. I mean, this girl probably taught jazzercise. No offense to my cousin who teaches jazzercise. I love you. But you are so peppy. And I gave it to my husband, who was my first reader, to read, and they have two other main primary characters, and he's kind of like, well, you know, this character's okay, this character's okay. So, what do you think about Libby? And it, all this damn burst, and I was like, I can't stand her. Can you stand her? She's awful. Like, I love spending time with her. And he's like, number one, okay, good, because the voice doesn't work. And number two, I can tell that you don't even like writing her. Whenever you go back to her chapters, it just feels incorrect. And so I've had several of those experiences. Somewhere they fit exactly. Like, I am Nick Dunn, basically. I mean, I am a fired pop culture writer from Missouri with a chip on my shoulder. Reads a lot of Velveeta. So that one, that came to me. I'm like, got this. But, so that's a long way, a long, long walk to asking you.
Just fast to the Velveeta. I'm just gonna, you know, we're never gonna forget this.
Velveeta, white bread, and some mayonnaise. I'll cut that. Edit that out.
Never. It's gonna be. It's on the Wayback Machine already. You know, for me, that the Sister Holiday's voice, the kind of DNA of it, is really the only thing that was very, very clear. And that is just because of the sort of singularity of it. And, you know, you're sort of like, you know, we talk to ourselves all day long, you know, May, but I was sort of, you know, chatting with this person. It was really different for me. I'm not, you know, even though, yes, I have some tattoos, but I've never been in a bar fight. I don't have a gold tooth. I didn't take a provisional vow with a novitiate and Sisters of Sublime Blood. I did grow up Catholic. I did go to Catholic school. Nuns were my teachers. But, you know, I wanted to make her of this lineage, but also completely different in that way. But the voice, it was always there. It's just then, of course, the plot that came later through like excruciating revisions and, you know, again, trying to find the rhythm that mapped with her voice and with the sleuthing. So, you know, you have this like funk, kind of sardonic, you know, beats up on students in her mind. You know, I play with some high camp. You know, there's a lot of Sister Act references. There's a lot of drag culture. There's a lot of queer theory and like kind of snapping, you know, as it were, because it's really hugely important to me in my life. But then there's also liturgical elements, and she's a true believer. You know, so she finds this, you know, passionate road to herself through through the Bible, through her work, through her service. And so that was, you know, interesting for me to write, because then I went back to work that I knew, you know, the Bible, and and she, you know, is the way she puts her, puts the both her spiritual compass and then her sleuthing obsession together is, you know, something that was really fun for me as well. And we see that, you know, with other spiritualists, like Father Brown or, you know, G.K. Chesterton. But yeah, it was the kind of fisticuffs, punk rock. Part of it was really, for me, the, almost the most important, because she is a hopeful character. She is very, very wounded. And but the detail, the kind of richness, the probing, going deeper, foraging, was part of her hope. And the reason why she wants to solve the crimes, not to, you know, think of justice in a very traditional sense, but to honor the preciousness of life, even though the world can be really vicious at times.
She's willing to hold her own weight. You watch her.
Life. Yes.
To me, really meaningful, in addition to being a very fun mystery. It's both of them.
There's a ruler scene as well.
don't worry, my friend.
Yeah, don't worry. It is, you know.
You went to Catholic school.
We both have stories on that.
I am curious because I usually make up my settings. You can identify them in spirit theory. You know, I say they're in Missouri, I say they're in Kansas. I can say a little bit the geography. But I'm so impressed that you had the guts to choose New Orleans, which is like that is a place that gets done over and over
thousands
again.
Thousands and thousands.
And it's so easy to become like cliched on it and sort of, you know, like, I'm gonna go have a beignet or, you know. Other things that we do in New Orleans, like you right now. But, you know, it's, I thought it was really gutsy, and the way you pull it off is amazing, because I feel like I'm there. I've visited New Orleans, I've never lived there, but I know the vibe of it, but it was kind of in the back of my head, and you articulated what makes it so special without having to do, like, the jazz bands constantly, or, you know, those signals of, we're in New Orleans. And so, what made you choose New Orleans, and how did you make sure to pick out to identify those specific granular details about it?
Thank you, and thanks for saying that. And I was so worried, like, when locals and friends from New Orleans and reviewers were reading it, I was like, oh my God, holding my breath. Because it has, you know, it is a storied place, and it's in all the books, and thousands of them. But for me, setting a story about rebirth and restarting over a new chapter, as well as the dance between life and death, New Orleans was the perfect place for that, because it's a place that has this buoyancy with disaster, hurricanes. I was in one. I lived there for 2 years, and you just kind of feel the ground just almost like lifting up, you know. But yet, it's this beautiful, remarkable, incredible, miraculous place. So it just felt like the ideal setting. And then, of course, I have to go back to it every, you know, time I want to write a new Sister Holiday book and do the research. But it's a place of, you know, creation as well. Jazz was formed there, you know, Black excellence and so many other aspects of American culture and Catholicism, you know, so many historic convents are there. And as a matter of fact, I live near one. So that was part of, you know, part of that background.
Did you do any, I mean, because the convent feels so real, it's in itself, and again, I tend to not do research because I always worry I'm going to hijack someone's story or, you know, start the journalist. You know, I was a former journalist, and that I'll start feeling too attached to different facts I've learned. So what I usually do is write everything that I want to happen and then go, could this happen? I mean, I remember sharp objects about little girls missing their teeth who were murdered. And I got to the end of it and I thought, holy, could this happen?
You did the right way, though.
Dentist, I called the dentist frantically.
Yes.
Bless that man for taking my call. I talked to a farmer after the fact when I wrote Dark Places, and there's I wanted to get the feel of being on a farm and what that felt day to day. That's what the characters were in. And I just wrote it from how I thought it would feel, you know, because I grew up in Kansas City and I certainly had experience in the rural life. So I did all this Kansas research. But then I talked to a farmer, one of my friends in Missouri, and went to his farm for a while. And then I kept peppering up questions, peppering. And I got to the last question. I was like, how hard would it be to kill a cow with a ritualistic burn? And he just never wrote me back. Okay, we're cutting you off.
Yep.
That's me. That's the way I do my research, but it's still so much fun. You feel so much like you're in the comment, like I can feel it. Is that purely from your mind of how you think it would be, or do you, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, you know, killing a cow with a new ritualistic axe or whatever, but yeah, let me know, give me a guess. But, you know, when you have a body, it's like falling, flaming, and, yeah. You know, there's a lot, it's all scorched, you know, the ecosystem is like burning, char, arson, you know, mm-hmm. So I did shadow the fire department chief, yeah, actually, one of the,
wow,
yeah, which was really remarkable, and I did a ride-along, the police officer was very kind to let me do that for 7 hours, actually, and...
In New Orleans.
That was in New England, in Northampton, okay. Yeah, yeah, that was...
You got the vibe of it.
So. Yeah. But... I do that the same way because there's an emotional truth to it, whether it's the teeth or the flaming bodies, or there's this emotional, almost like poetic need for that as part of the story. So then, okay, maybe then we'll go back and tweak the details to make it credible for the reader because we want to immerse you. This is your world, you know. This is out of the hands, so as credible and as believable as we can make it within the realms of fiction, because obviously that's, you know, hugely important, but I think that's the way I do it too, is just follow that like urgent need to see that thing happen, because then that sparks so much else. Yeah. But yeah, I had to tweak a lot of details about like the fire.
And how beholden do you feel that? Because that's, to me, is always interesting. Like, how much... I always feel like I get away a little bit with mine because they're a dash of heightened realities, you know, a vibe. And, you know, in some ways, they acknowledge along the way that they're stories because they're usually so much about media or storytelling or, you know, two expert... Nick and Amy, two expert... spinners of their own mythology against each other, and so I always feel like, to me, I think I'm not writing a nonfiction book, that's not my intent, so, you know, I feel more beholden to what feels correct creatively, and ultimately, I mean, unless it's actually completely impossible to happen in the realm of fantasy, I usually side on, you know, the way of fiction. It's fictionalizing.
Absolutely. And, you know, these your books, they're people stories. They're how they, like, how Camille Preaker saw the story of her life to the reader. Sister Holliday is telling her story, so it's darkly satirical. You know, there's a lot of exaggeration because that's what feels real to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. I tend to do the same because, again, it's like locking in the voice, and the way that we all, you know, talk is different. And so, you know, the way that basically the details are being rendered, I think they're fitting within that worldview. So yeah, I give it a lot. A long runway.
Yeah.
Long, long runway. As long as it feels kind of, again, emotionally true.
Mm-hmm. You're a teacher.
Yes.
How do you
After
feel?
Being a very bad student. Yeah.
Bad student.
I couldn't sit still.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it just, in my mind as well. You know, I just...
Is that part of your creativity, do you think?
Yeah.
That started, that not being able to...
Yeah. I mean, I realized in my 40s that I have ADHD. Mm-hmm. So I'm neurodivergent. And, you know, girls were never told that. Like, it was always boys, basically. And so I always thought it was normal to have almost 2 or 3 thoughts at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel material so deeply. It's almost like synesthesia. Like, I feel it all around me almost at all times. As I'm reading it, I feel like I'm literally living it. Every character in this book, I have felt every single thing that they're feeling, even the pets. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So for me, that's the real gift and the blessing of art, is that we can, you know, feel that. Mm-hmm. But yes, I'm a teacher.
Well, I'm gonna loop back to, actually, I'm just gonna go in with that. So that's interesting, because I feel like my creativity came from being a painfully, painfully shy kid. Just literally could not talk aloud with people I didn't know. It just wouldn't have happened.
Too nervous? Just...
I almost felt like a chemical thing. I almost felt like a true inability. I had so much going on in my head. And
yeah.
Then people would leave and I'd be like, I was so clever in my head. I was brilliant. I had so much to say. Like, I was the kid, I would know the answer and I couldn't raise my hand because I could not bear to do it. And this was all the way through college too. I mean, it kept me from doing a lot of things that I wanted to do. But what it did help me to do is I was a constant narrator of my day as I was going online. And, you know, my mom taught reading, so I always had books. My dad taught film, and so I always watched movies. And so it was very, that part was very normal for me also, to just be inside my head and be like, she walked down the lonely hallway to the counselor's office where she would fail to say anything yet again, and then be sent back to class where she would also fail. And that's all right, because she's awesome. But I do think, like, that doing that made me a natural, when I decided when I started writing a novel, it was kind of organic because I'd spent my whole life in my head. And so,
yeah.
I mean, you also were in your head, but in a different way. So I'm curious if you feel like that's what led to your creative mind.
Absolutely. And I love that you say that because, like, it's almost creating a muscle memory for that depth, just like that deeper, going deeper into those details that are so, that create the texture, you know, of an experience. So for me, it was different. You know, I was a total extrovert, as you might be able to tell. And I love people and I love social experiences, but there's always this, you know, I could write a book about this water bottle or this cat or this, you know, just tell me where to look, and you know what, I'm kind of there. So for me, it was writing, my art, reading also, such a gift, because it brings it all into this almost beautiful cohesion, so that I'm fully there. And my favorite way to read books, I don't know if anybody, I'd love to see a show of hands, is to start in the morning and finish it like either that night or over the weekend. Like, I love to devour, right? And just tear through a book. It just feels so good. And that's also how I like to, you know, write. So when you're talking about that, like, improvisation or going off track.
Yeah.
I can do that within, you know, realm of almost having a little, like, again, like a roadmap a little bit. Mm-hmm. But that's, to me, where that expression of, like, true, you know, coming to life, where that, like, Frankenstein moment of, like, it's alive.
Yeah.
Is that deep, deep immersion. But yeah, it's different than your experience, mm-hmm. because of the kind of intensity and, yeah, you know, just the, what I can get from that, which is just, like, very...
Doesn't matter how, like, you get there, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
I'm never bored.
It's just interesting that you, right?
Maybe, you know, I can sometimes always retreat inside
myself.
Yeah.
find it very easy to do. I'm an introvert, so I'm just the opposite. Like, and that doesn't mean I don't like being out and about. It's just where you get your energy from. And, like, so I'm kind of a natural writer because I'm just fine being alone by myself for 8 hours. And if I don't sort of have that, so I'm very, like, I have that very internalized thing. But you and I both get there. So, it's, again, it's, like, kind of a reminder to anyone who wants to write. Like, people ask me, you know, what do you need to know to be a writer? What do you need to do? And I always say, you need to write. You know, you just need to write. And there's no, you can read. I mean, I remember wanting to be a writer and spending several years preparing to be a writer and reading all the books on writing and, you know, writing interviews and how do you do it? And I realized ultimately there is no correct way. Like, there's some great tips out there. There's some great ways to do it. I love Animals Bird by Bird. I love Stephen King's On Writing. I mean, both brilliant, but in the end, you're gonna eat it. Like, you need to sit down and write, and it's gonna sometimes be miserable.
Bloodbath. And then sometimes absolute ecstasy.
Yes.
Depends.
Look at you always going on the upside. Here I am.
I mean, I can say bloodbath.
It's probably the same.
Are there writers in the group? People writing? Yeah. Writing mysteries, crime fiction, like poetry, small, like little clips of things. Yeah, right. Poetry. Let's hear poetry. Poetry month. Yeah, everybody has, you know, we all have different fingerprints. Like, you have your own way of writing. And but it is fun to hear about what works for other people and you can try stuff out. And maybe it will work, maybe not, maybe a little piece of it.
Yeah.
But the best, you know, way to write better is reading widely, reading generously.
Yes.
Everything. Science fiction, nonfiction, journalism. Mm-hmm. Like, the more I read, the better I write.
Read modern, read classics. I just finished Slaughterhouse-5.
So good.
Oh, never, like, oh, I weep.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes classics are classics for a reason, sometimes they're not, but mostly they are. And, you know, that's what I always say, like, if you say, I don't read this type of genre, or I don't read that kind of book, you're kind of, to me, you're marking yourself as not very well read. You know, read, why not read across everything? Because there's great stuff. Great writing all across the way. Westerns, come on. True
so
Grit.
So good.
Yeah. It's amazing. But
so good.
I got sidetracked. Teaching.
Get
back to teaching. You're teachers. How do you feel, or do you, if teaching influences your writing?
Because you see what the students are doing, and it's alive, it's living, breathing discipline, and everybody makes it their own whenever you sit down to write a draft, whatever it is. So it keeps it very, the beating heart of it is just ever louder in my ear when I'm teaching. And then the concepts themselves, you look at them every which way, you know, the idea of structure, plot, what is suspense, you know, how do we maintain suspense, timing, like all of these core concepts, especially within crime fiction, all the incredible books here at Poison Pen, you know, what does it mean to deliver a twist? What is the MacGuffin? You know, so taking these ideas that are core and hallmark to the genres, and then, like, how much can we push it? You know, again, added up weird, unsleuth, hard-boiled, inspired, satirical, you know, like, how much can we explore with our genres? And then you look at other books that are extraordinary and you realize, wait, they're doing that too. They're all, you know, so it just, I feel like the biggest gift to me is to be able to teach. Because then I get to save a student forever in a way that works for me, which is, you know, it keeps it just like this, almost this dance. Mm-hmm. That's very vital.
Sounds like very invigorating. I think I'd be innervated by the end of the day, but again, you and I can see from different places. I mean, I think I would love it in the moment, but I think I would leave it all in the field, sort of like finish teaching, and I don't know if I'd have room for writing, or after that. So
yeah.
I'm really impressed.
Oh, thanks. I mean, it is you know, an incredible gift to be able to live in that world, and it just, you know, and then all the books that are part of popular culture, you know, perhaps maybe more obscure, looking at them, you know, through the student's eyes as well, it just makes me appreciate it. And
I mean, like I said, both my parents were teachers, and I thought I would go into teaching, and then got in front of an audience when I was 22. Huge epic fail. We had a recording of that.
I mean, but
the red shirt.
I mean, I don't know who said it. Somebody great. It was either like Oprah or Heidegger or somebody. It was like, you want to make a connection, not an impression. And for me, that's like my world. You know, I don't, you know, I want to connect with people. I want to connect with readers. I want to connect with you, with everybody, rather than like seem like I have it all together, which I am absolutely would never in a million years. So that's just all I teach as well.
Right.
Just like straight from the jump, like we're all beautiful messes.
Yes, yes. And I feel like there's become more room for female narrators who are the light and the dark, so
yeah,
we do acknowledge their men.
No room for that.
Yeah, it was a long time coming. I mean, I remember shopping around Sharp Objects, my first book, and it got regularly declined. And what we kept hearing was, no one wants to read about dark women. They want to read about aspirational women. They want to read about women they can root for, but they definitely don't want these messed up dark narrators. So get us back on your next book if it's more cheery.
Really? That's really what...
Oh my god, yeah. Yeah. You know, and I got picked up, thank goodness, but there was a massive pass. There was an aggressive pass on it. And that was consistently what we kept hearing. And that was, you know, that was a while ago. That was 2007, I think, when it came out. 2006.
Wow.
So, you know, not even, you know, 15 years ago or something. So I think a lot has changed since then, and I think there's a lot more room for that. I'm grateful for that, because I feel like for a long time I was like, well, what does that leave women to do except for to help and vote in there, you know, and they're the helpmate, they're the, you know, the rom-com clumsy gal who can't get it together even though she loves a career and has Cosmos. You know, and I was like, let's see how nasty and ugly we are. Women are just the same as men. Like, let's acknowledge it all.
Human experience.
That's what I was like. It's called actually just being a human being. It's not being a, you know.
Yeah, and
I love that.
So that's, but then Gone Girl was different because you had Sharp Objects out first, but then there wasn't a similar, or was there, you know, a pushback against that idea? Complex.
No, I mean, yeah. So it was Molly Stern, the great Molly Stern, who is my editor for Gone Girl, my publisher for Gone Girl, and who is in charge of Xanda, which is where my imprint is, and why I'm at Xanda. So I have to give it to Molly Stern and just tell you that, like, Gone Girl is a weird book when you think about it. You know, it's a book with two not particularly likable narrators. It's a whodunit. You find out whodunit in the middle of the book, and it has an ending that's not entirely buttoned up and with a little bow. And I remember her saying to me, like, gee, do you know these three things? I said, indeed I do, and I was trying to do that, so good. And she said, great, and never asked me again. It really protected me and protected Gone Girl the whole way. So give it to her, and that is why I'm at Xando, so I shouldn't add that. Like, it's because of Molly Stern. And so that's why Gillian Flynn Books is there, and that's what happened with Gone Girl. It's like I really felt covered, and there was no second guess at all.
And luckily all the millions and millions of people who read the book and loved it, you know, because someone took a chance on, you know, stood by you in your artistic vision. And so thank you for doing that for me. And Scorched Grace, because, yeah, we, you know, I had the great fortune to work with an agent who also saw what I was doing and liked the weirdness of it and liked the big creative swing of it. And we did hear The writing is terrific. It's just we don't know how to exactly market it within our list.
Mm-hmm.
A couple. And then we did have some offers, but it was just the idea of trying to do something that to me felt like, you know, bringing the kind of a book that I would want to read.
Right.
Because of my tremendous love for crime fiction and poetry and queer protagonists who are not either heroes or anti-heroes, but just, you know, themselves and not want to be stuck into one category.
Right. And I mean, another great moment for how you write, which is you write all the way until you have a book that, and you say, well, I'd read this.
Yeah.
And that's really all you can do ultimately. Like, it's so dangerous to write toward a market. It's so dangerous to write toward what you think will be popular. You really have to write toward, like, well, I really like this book. Like, I would read this book if I were not me, who had already read this book 1,000 times. but yeah, I mean, I think that's what Scorched Grace is so beautiful at. Like, you feel it comes from a place of assurance. You know, it's always nice to land with a writer where within those first 10 pages, you're like, oh, you got me, like, I'm going to keep reading because you know what you're doing, like, you know what you're saying. And I mean, that's what I love about all the writers I like with Joyce Carol Oates, even as cuckoo as she gets, with Dennis Lehane.
Urgent, it's like so, urgent and inevitable.
Yes.
Like, there's, like, your work in so many of these incredible books, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's just no hedging, you just...
Yeah.
You go right in.
This person, I'm in this person's brain.
Yes.
Because
writing is a form of thinking.
Yeah.
So it's like you're reading their thoughts. You're their thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to take questions, Gilly?
Oh, absolutely. Let's do it.
Yeah. I'm trying not to be a spoiler because I've read the book. And I love Sister Holiday. I love her.
Yes.
Very attached to her. But I was curious. I mean, I don't think she outright says it in the book, but it seems very clear to me, and you were talking about at the beginning, the austerity of the convent.
Yeah.
There are some issues around fire, and you talked about her being a wounded person, and it feels very much to me like she thought, okay, I'm going to raise my hand, and I'm going to go from Brooklyn to New Orleans and do my penance. It very much, I don't think she actually says that, but you feel it.
Yes.
And I'm sort of wondering if when she immediately jumps in and is like, I am solving this arson,
yes,
if that also had a connection to doing.
Absolutely.
You don't find it out initially, right? So it takes some time to get to the thing that I'm trying not to spoil.
Yeah. You're doing a great job.
Okay, I just want to make sure I'm making sense. But
you're doing a lot of somersaults.
Yeah, it's like really in hindsight, you kind of go, oh, is that why she was like knocking people over and,
yeah,
you know, getting in the cop's face and doing, it was sort of that, I got the impression she was really kind of doing some penance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You are right.
Okay, good.
You are any...
Yeah, I love that.
Thank you.
And I love her.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, she actually, for writing this book was so reparative for me because I had a lot of trauma. Like, I grew up in the Catholic Church. My parents were very religious. My uncle's a deacon in the Maronite Catholic Church. And, you know, but I always loved the stained glass and, you know, the incense and just getting knocked out with that frankincense. And, but it wasn't, I never felt the call myself. So I felt this tremendous distance of writing this, like, this character was this bridge between my worlds, you know, to give this kind of unique voice. But I feel like there's so many ways that we're driven by the past or emotions or unfinished business that show up, whether, you know, somebody, I don't know if you have any friends that are like really geniuses in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have my friend Brent, if you're watching. There's like people that just like jump right in, you know, but like what's motivating that sometimes? So, you know, you got it right there.
Yeah, she had a lot of pain, and I just thought, you know, but you don't see it right at first. So
that's what they're great about is like, and I think great about all good character driven mysteries is the crumbs are along the way, and when you get to the end, you go, ah, and they're so blended beautifully together. I love any book where you're solving the mystery of who the character is as much as you are solving the mystery itself, and that's what this book certainly is.
I think mysteries nest. You know, we got multiple mysteries at once, and I love delivering at least like 3 twists. You know, that's just like my personal thing. Like, you know, and hopefully I do that here, and because we love a twist. You know, you're doing Gone Girl, the twist is like right in the middle. Yeah. But then they keep coming. It's like a stone that you take and you like skip it and skips on. You're like, oh my God, it's still going. And that's what I just love that, because it just lives on in your mind. Like, oh.
The key to that for me is I write, you know, as I go. And sometimes I'll switch who the killer is. Sometimes I switch the mystery. Sometimes, you know, I'm kind of going along. And then people will say, like, oh, I did not see that coming. That so-and-so was the bad guy. And I'm like, nor did I. Keep allowing rewrite number 8.
Love it. Any other questions?
I heard you on the Writer Files podcast.
Oh, big yeah, Captain Reed.
Yeah, yeah, that's why I'm here. That's how I found out. I love
you.
The book.
Thank
and
you.
Your
so
writing
much.
Is lyrical, it's a good description, and just really interesting, fun book. You talked about it being opted.
Optioned, yeah.
Yes, can you talk more about that?
Oh, gosh. If this were like 2 weeks from now,
yeah.
I would love to tell you, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just like really, I was just like writing to Molly about it. There is really great news coming soon.
Oh, okay.
It's just like a really exciting, like it could not be. I mean, first of all, I could never even imagine sitting here with you, like in this great place, even 2 years ago or 10 years ago. You know, yes, I'm a teacher. I worked in a hair salon for 5 years. Like, I was a campus security guard. I almost got fired from my job because I was hanging out at the dive bar on duty. I've had a very storied past. Writing's always been the thing. Writing, you know, and storytelling. But when you, you know, changed my life, and then you know, a lot of option interest came after that. Maybe because of a little film called Gone Girl, or you know, something like that.
Yeah, but your book.
I'm like here for it 1,000,000%. But yeah, the folks that are optioning it are just like my dream, beyond my wildest dreams. So yeah, it's really great, and just their vision for it is really exciting.
Is it going to be a series or a movie? A series.
Yeah, okay. Limited edition or like a series. So Scorched Grace will be hopefully, you know, series one and. Blessed Waters, which is the second book, which should be out at the Poison Pen next year.
March, I was just going to sneak in, and here I am. Sorry, I was behind you. But I always like to ask the authors, leaving you on a high note, waiting for the next book, what it is they're working on. So tell us more, and then maybe Gilly, you can tell us if there's any news.
Yeah, it's some news. But yeah, and thanks for that question. Yeah, this is the first book in a trilogy, and although for fans, you know, I am going to do a Sister Holiday Christmas flash fiction three pager you could read in line at Cartel Coffee waiting for your cappuccino or something, because I love little, like, the hard-boiled, the Black Mask style of,
right.
Like, short stories, so stay tuned for Xando for news on that, but this is the first in a trilogy, the second is Blessed Water, and... It's shorter. Salud. It takes place over 3 days, Good Friday, Saturday, and Easter Sunday. Mm-hmm. Starts with Sister Holiday, you know, pulling somebody out of a Mississippi River, and it's very, very fast. And then third book is Ravaged Vow. Do you like that title? Do you like that?
I do.
What's workshop? when you want. Or when Scorched Grace, was it always a trilogy? Just two?
Hoping it was a trilogy, but we were following Margot's lead, but bought it as a two book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Right. So do you have any news for us that you can talk about?
I am just wrapping up the next book. I'm finally, you know, I was doing movies and I had finished doing a TV show. And I thought I'd immediately write the book, and then COVID happened, and I was homeschooling. And I thought, oh, I'm homeschooling my two kids for a little bit, and I'll write on the side. That did not happen. There was no writing on the side. And so I have finally now recommitted and gotten, like, really grind, gotten the, like, full commitment day to day, which is what I always need to be.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so almost.
Feeling good?
Feeling, you know, always feeling
the high bill before. The ecstasy part.
It's totally a little bit of both, but I'm finally on the draft stage, which, like, the rewrite stage, which is my favorite, because the scary part is getting to the end. But then you can see everything that's wrong with it, and then I love it. I do like 3 or 4 rewrites, and I'm toward my last rewrite, so I'm almost good.
So is Molly still editing you?
I wish I could say that.
No,
yeah,
because she's
Mando. No. Now I've betrayed my own editor.
Sorry.
She's full time publishing at Zando, so.
No, I understand that, but
I always love Molly's opinion on anything.
Well,
she's
brilliant. Yeah. It doesn't mean she can't, like, freelance in, whatever. But I didn't, you know, this was an imprint that you're doing, but did you edit this book yourself?
Oh, no, I did not. I read the book, and I leave the editing to the brilliant editors at Sandow.
Yeah, Serena Kamath is incredible. She's a fabulous editor. Molly's assembled an incredible team. That is your team.
So, you know, I read them, and I choose, you know, I say, oh, let's try to get a hold of this book. But then I would not be a good editor. I'm just way too, like, let's get in here. You know, I can't say what my ultimate vision is. I tend to go in and just read, you know, fiddle with it. And there's a real art to editing. There's that sort of make you articulate what you're doing, make you defend what you're doing. Of course, if the editor doesn't think it's working, and sometimes I find the editor is wrong, and it helps me make it better.
Yeah.
I have, I'm forced to explain what I think I'm doing. And sometimes you go, you start trying to articulate why you should have that piece, and you're like, yeah, you're right. I don't know why I had it. I must have been bored one day. I stuck it in there.
Right, so having an imprint is, I mean, basically it's more of an acquisition activity, right?
Yes, I should never say I'm an editor there at all. I mean, yes, exactly. No, I'm the person who acquires and loves the book and jumps in along the way.
In your next book, The Center by Aisha, is going to be out in June or July?
July, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Great imprint.
And we haven't really mentioned
Warped Thriller. So the LA Times called your imprint the Warped Thriller imprint.
Oh boy.
And I think you've all noticed the amazing cover art that for Margot's book. Mm-hmm. And I think that if Zando keeps that up, that, you know, their books are going to make a real splash.
Yeah.
For nothing else, they will display fabulously.
So different.
Gorgeous.
And they really are. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. They are. So is there a last question anybody would like to raise? No. Did you say you had a student here?
No, there is a poetry student here. Uh-huh. Some of my students might be watching.
Okay.
Barbara, I have one from
you have
online.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's that?
Someone named Dallas, whose books you signed in the back. Question for Gillian. Of the characters she's created, which character resonates the most with her?
Mm-hmm.
And is there anyone she would ever feel tempted to revisit in a book?
Ooh, great question.
I would say the one that vibes with me most is probably my first narrator. I wrote that at an angsty time, dark time in my life, and I kind of wrote my way out of that darkness partly through Camille Freaker. And so I'm very, that character really, she means a lot to me. You know, and the others were super fun to write, but, you know, they're, and everything, every character has a piece of you in it, right? Every single character does. But I think that's the one most, that's closest. And I would revisit, like, all of them, but I think probably Nick and Amy Dunn from Gone Girl are the ones most likely to return. I keep thinking about Let's say they had a child. When that child becomes a teenager, what that little household might be. I'm not promising anything, but I do keep thinking about that. So thanks, Dallas, for making me say that out loud.
Well, so thank you for coming. We generally, as many of you know, have been to our events. I'd like to give away an advanced reading copy of a book that is not yet published, but in fact, this one, Small Mercies by Dennis Lehane, will be published on Tuesday. And Dennis has signed books for us, so we can't sell them to you until Tuesday, but we actually have them. And Gillian will be talking to Dennis sometime this week, but Patrick and I will be talking to Dennis with Michael Carita next Sunday, not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow. At, what is it, 4 o'clock? 5 o'clock, and it's on Zoom, so it's not here at the bookstore. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it. Well, I have to compare. Is yours going to be recorded so we can see what the Gillian Flynn, Dennis Lehane conversation is?
We always have a good conversation. So,
you do?
Yeah, I adore him. He's the reason I'm a writer in a way, because I read Mystic River, and that's how I figured out how to write my first book, Sharp Objects, was after reading Mystic River through the night, going to my day job next day, and just kind of like, I think this is why I'm trying to say what I say, because I can, anyway, stop. So I'm always honored to speak with them.
And in fact, Gillian did. Dennis came here, passed through, and signed copies of his 20th anniversary, it would have been, of Mystic River. But then he and Gillian did a conversation for us. And since we are now well over 1,000 Zoom conversations, we're working on an index. We finally found a use for chat, whatever it is. What is it called?
Chat GPT?
Yeah, GPT. My husband is going to use it to generate an index for all of these other events, so you don't have to scroll through Facebook videos to find it. But it was a fabulous conversation, and there were some 62,000 people that have watched it. Wow. So, you know, I think that's wonderful. But anyway, often we do this by number, but I would like to give this copy today to a bookseller who came down here and actually delivered a copy of Gone Girl so that we could sell it to you. So I'm going to give it to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh.
She's also an poetry student.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.